Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her here. And certainly, if you want to join in with a question about your pet's health, I hope you'll do that. Call us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
It is so nice to be back.
Great to have you back.
Yeah, you know, just before I came here, we had a phone call from an owner who had a little tube of medication to treat her dog for a little minor skin infection, left it on the counter, and the dog ate it. She wasn't concerned about the medication that the dog, that's supposed to be applied topically, now is going orally, which is probably not going to be a big deal. But that didn't bother her. She was just worried, is she going to be able to pass this tube? And I thought about, you know, all the weird things I've found in dogs' bodies. And there's a contest every year that one of the veterinary journals does. And this was the winners of the 2010 X-ray contest.
Let's hear it.
Well, number one, grand prize winner was a two-year-old hound who had eaten 309 screws, nails, and fence staples and was vomiting. No surprise, surprise. And they had to go in and remove them. Number two was an entire telephone cord. They, you know, wound up, you know, the little squirrely cord like that. Number three was a paring knife. Dog had swallowed, pulled a paring knife down off the table. And, you know, these are just some of the things. And I thought, wouldn't that be neat if people call up and when they're asking other questions, maybe say, hey, this is what my dog or my cat ate. And yeah.
We'll see if we've, I bet there'll be a few callers
there
today.
There might be.
We'll have an unusual tale to tell.
Okay.
Let's go to the phones. And Sherry in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a couple questions for the doctor. We got a puppy about a month ago, and he's now about 3 months old, and he's got parasites and worms. He's taking Albon, and he has had some accidents on our wood floor, and of course we clean it up, but I'm wondering if we have to like sanitize it to try to get rid of the parasites if they'll reinfect him or reinfect our cat.
Yeah. That's a really good question. That when I hear that a puppy is being treated with Albon, my guess is that your puppy was diagnosed with an intestinal parasite called coccidia. Uh-huh. And coccidia is an organism that is very species specific, so you don't have to worry about you getting infected, unlike other dog parasites that can affect people. And you also don't have to worry about your cat getting infected. For the majority of puppies that get exposed to this parasite, it is, in the majority of cases, a self-limiting disease, meaning they may come in with perfectly normal stool, and we just happen to find that they're passing coccidia, and they will usually clear it on their own. Sometimes, though, when we get a puppy that, when they're stressed, you've done a diet change, you're vaccinating them, they've gone from the breeders to your home, then they can maybe start showing some clinical signs, which is usually diarrhea when they have this particular parasite. The drug that we have to use does not kill it, but just helps the body get rid of it. And so you have to use it for a long time, like 14 to 21 days. So it's real important that you use it for the entire course that your veterinarian has prescribed it for. And because of the nature of the drug, you need to make sure that they're taking in lots of water, because it's a drug that is excreted through the kidneys. So if your dog has diarrhea, make sure that they're staying well hydrated while they're on that particular medication, because you wouldn't want to cause the body more harm by affecting the kidneys. So no worries about your cat, no worries about you. And once this parasite is in the environment, it's really hard to get rid of, but that's typically more in soil and areas like that. Just, you know, physically cleaning the floor. You can use, you know, any standard disinfectant. Just make sure if there's any residue in any of the nooks and crannies of the floor, you get in there with a good scrub brush and clean that up. But even if your dog were to get reinfected, as they grow up, the chances of them having clinical signs are pretty slim.
All right.
Okay, thank you. I have one more question.
Sure.
This little dog, he will go to the bathroom outside if somebody's with him. Now, if no one's with him, he just hangs around the door and cries.
Oh, well, you know, you are doing the right thing, though, because you want to be outside with your dog when they're having to eliminate, because part of house training is getting that positive reinforcement in as soon as the puppy's fanny's coming up off the ground. So you literally have to be right out there. The the puppy's a baby. He's only 3 months old. And the backyard can be a kind of a big scary place if they're, you know, not used to it. And so a few things that I would recommend doing, though, is you be outside with the dog when it's going to the bathroom. But at other times during the day, it's important for all puppies to start learning that they can be separated from humans and the world will not come to an end. So if your dog has a comfortable place like a crate or a puppy playpen that it spends some time, make sure that every day you're leaving that puppy for an hour or two or more, if you can, so that they start learning that you can go and you can come back and guess what? You know, I survive. But right now, I'd still be recommending that you go outside with the dog.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Steve in Sun Prairie, let's go to you now. Hi, Steve.
Hey, good morning. I have a question. I've been seeing ads on television for some sort of a dental treatment spray for at least cats, and I'm a little bit concerned about it. First of all, would it work? And secondly, if it's strong enough to work, wouldn't it be a little bit rough on the cat's gums and oral tissues?
Yeah.
Sure.
And if you would just go ahead and tell us about it, I'd be interested in listening. So would Gus, George, and Gracie, who are not crazy about the idea. We'll listen on the radio.
And you know what? Thank you. And two of those cats are actually blood donors at the veterinary school.
Oh.
People don't realize that, you know, we need to have blood donors come in. So I recognized the voice. And when he said the names, I was like, oh, I know this person. And people, I'm not getting to the question yet, but people don't realize that every species of animal has to have their own blood. We can't use dog's blood in a cat or whatever.
Right.
And he has two wonderful cats that help other patients
great.
Out. He even went one time in the middle of the night, got called in at like midnight to bring his cats in for a critical patient. So thank you, Steve, for doing that with your kitty cats. Regarding things to clean the mouth with, yes, I'm always concerned about something that's a miracle treatment to be able to remove you know, plaque and so on from the cat's mouth. What most people don't realize is that by the time they actually see tartar on the cat's teeth, that soft, easy to remove stuff called plaque has already been mineralized. And so anything you spray on or whatever is not going to get rid of that hard tartar. What, you know, the ideal thing is to get rid of the plaque every day. And there aren't any rinses or sprays that work well. Our dentist at the vet school just say, you know, just don't even bother, because most of those products, especially in humans, like the anti-plaque rinses and things, you need to swish in your mouth for a while. Well, trying to convince your cat to gargle is not going to work. So we don't recommend using that. Best things you can do for keeping your cat's teeth clean, the number one thing is brushing. Cats don't see the humor in it, but remember, when we're brushing a pet's teeth, we're doing it for a totally different reason than we do for us. We brush our teeth primarily to prevent cavities. So we like to brush after we eat. In dogs and cats, we can brush before they eat because we're trying to prevent periodontal disease, which is a whole different problem that can occur in the mouth. So I like to have owners, you know, introduce the toothbrush right before they're going to get something really tasty to eat. In fact, even putting some of the food on the toothbrush helps get the cat used to having the brush put in their mouth. So that's number one. Number two would be oral care diets. There are diets on the market that either contain an anti-plaque agent called hexametaphosphate, HMP, and some of them also are these fibrous-type foods that are bigger chunks that the cat has to chew to be able to swallow. And those products have been found to be very successful at keeping plaque and cutting down on tartar buildup too. So using a special diet would be helpful. These are available through your veterinarian. There are some that you can get over the counter, but they're not quite as good as the prescription diets. And, you know, lastly, there are some treats on the market. And, you know, again, with treats, it's like a one-time deal. The cat gets a crunch and down it goes. That's where having it be the cat's entire diet, not the treats, but the special diet is better idea than using cat treats.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Got up at midnight. Huh?
He did, yes, to save a patient
good.
At the hospital. So, yes, all those owners of our blood donors need to be applauded for, you know, their caring and their effort. So, yep. Well, and the pets, too, that are donating.
Pets, you bet. Well, let's turn to Joanne in Green Bay next. Joanne, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Okay, I have just I have a Maine Coon. He is 34 pounds. Ooh. I finally got him down to 28. And then I brought him to the vet. I bring him every month because he has to get enemas constantly, and now I give them to him myself because he's got irritable bowel syndrome.
Uh-huh.
So he can't go to the bathroom. It's hard for him, and it hurts. So I bring him in a lot. And I recently realized he's getting angry at me. I give him 3 times a day, 3/4 cups of food, and that's what I've been having him on a schedule with. And recently he's been just constantly acting like he is just starving, crying, sitting by his dish. He swats me when I walk by now.
Uh-oh.
And he's actually bitten the side of my leg. Not mean. But,
oh,
you know,
how controlling. Almost, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know what to do because I don't want people to think I'm starving him. He's like, you know, but I do have another cat, so I have to feed him in a different room.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, but I don't know what to do. I mean, if I don't feed him even just a little bit, I've tried to cut it up even the 3/4 just to a couple.
Yeah.
And fed him more frequently, but he won't stop. And
okay.
He eats so fast all the time.
Yeah.
That he can get sick.
Yeah, and it sounds like you have a cat that is very controlling, that, you know, it's like, feed me now, and is willing to, you know, use a little force to be able to have you be his personal waitress. So what I would recommend doing is, instead of you being the one to deliver the food, consider getting like an automatic feeder that goes off, where he can sit and wait at the automatic feeder. They've got some pretty interesting ones out now that will dispense food and, you know, give him his, you know, time. You can time it at certain times of the day so that, again, he sits there and you don't have to be the one that pushes gets his buttons pushed by, being too slow at dishing the food up. It's the machine that's doing it. There's a thing on the market that you may want to look into that, again, dispenses food, but it does it remotely. And it's called the Manners Minder. And if you just Google it, it's a device that holds food, and you have a remote control button. And it's not that expensive. I think, well, it's like $100, I think, for the thing. But you can even get it on Amazon and so on. So you can be in another room, and the machine will make a buzz and dispense a certain amount of food, a couple of pieces of kibble or whatever. So he will start learning, when that buzz goes, I run to the bowl, and you can be far away from it. So that might be another way of being able to feed him with you being at a distance from him. These are controlling cats can be really tough. They're kind of like the controlling dog. And, you know, trying to teach him that, you know, nothing in life is free like we do for dogs, and that they have to work for a living is not something that most owners think about doing with their cats. But if you can start training him as well, once you've got him, you know, maybe trained to the buzz, that now you can be a little bit closer. And as he's prancing around the machine, as soon as his fanny hits the ground, you can say, sit, buzz the machine, and he gets a treat. So he learns, wow, when she says that, fanny hits the ground, I get a treat. That way, you are actually putting, you know, it back in your hands again. You're asking him to do something for you before you deliver the food. So be looking into some cat obedience training as well. It can be done. Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I hope you can help us take days off our fall pledge drive. For every 800 donations we get ahead of time, we're taking one day off, which I think is a good thing. And right now, we're 517 pledges away from taking the first day off. So go to WPR.org, donate now, and we can take a day off. We get another 517 pledges. Let's do a few this hour. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest. We'll take some more calls now. Ann in Duluth up next. Ann, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I have a 9-year-old standard poodle who has immune-mediated non-erosive polyarthritis. And we have controlled that. She was diagnosed when she was just a year old. And we've controlled it really well. We've used prednisone and exercise and weight control, and she's done very well until about the last year. She's also has a bleeding. She bleeds out, and so we have to we can't use aspirin-related drugs for her for pain. This year, in the last 6 months, she's become dramatically worse and now can't jump into the car. Things are just generally tougher for her. Walking upstairs particularly seems to be difficult. I'm wondering what we're looking at. Is this a typical response as they get older, and is there anything more we can do, or is this just kind of the way it's going to be?
Well, anytime you've got a dog with arthritis, no matter what the cause is, and unfortunately, if she's got an immune-mediated type of arthritis, she's got cartilage damage, it's been going on for a number of years, and even though you've been attempting to control it with immunosuppressive drugs like prednisone, there's still going to be damage done. And so addressing it like we do any dog with arthritis, and this would include, and obviously your dog is not able to take the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories that are available, and there's lots of those out there for dogs. Some other things that I would be looking at for pain control would be, there's a centrally acting drug called tramadol that we use a lot of in dogs that don't tolerate NSAIDs. So talk to your veterinarian about using that. It's not very expensive. Dogs tolerate it real well. Maybe a tinge of sedation, but most owners don't even recognize that. So that might be something that you would want to give a try. There was an article published recently regarding using fish oil as a adjunct to non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, and they found that by adding in a fish oil supplement with the right levels of omega-3 fatty acids, that you were able to cut down on the level of NSAIDs that you were giving the dog. Obviously, you're not using that, but I still think using a fish oil supplement would be an excellent idea for your dog if you're not already doing that. Some of the joint diets that are available for dogs, Hill's makes one called JD, and Nestle Purina makes one called JM, are foods that are rich in these fatty acids, but even adding a supplement to those diets are going to be helpful for your dog as well. Any other joint support agents like glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, those types of drugs, there's a number of products on the market. Your veterinarian can tell you which one they like. The two products that I probably flip-flop back and forth are either Glycoflex 3, and there's another one called Cosequin or Dasequin, and I typically go with the one called Dasequin. So those would be ones you could try as well. Other pain medications that you might want to consider trying too would be, there's one called gabapentin that we use, goes by the name of Neurontin, and some dogs tolerate it and are not very sedated on it, so others get a little more sedated, but that might be another one that you could add in as well. And then be looking at things like ramps for getting in and out of the car, helping your dog with slings and things, like putting a towel or something under their belly to give you a handle so that you can help lift her up, in and out.
Okay.
And orthopedic foam beds, anything like that to just make, her day-to-day living a little more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry that she's, showing her age already with this horrible
right?
disease. Yeah, yeah.
What are we talking in terms of dosage for fish oil?
It's based on weight, and you want to use at least, I think it's like a 3.5% omega-3 fatty acid supplement. And so, talking to your veterinarian regarding, I always have to go to the brand that we carry in our pharmacy and look at the box, because they tell you, how much per pound of body weight you have to use. And
okay.
I don't know the exact dose. So, but that would be something your veterinarian could help you with.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call and good luck. We turn to Sarah Lou in Milwaukee next. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, I'm actually calling. I have a 9-year-old beagle, and she seems to have a lot of ear problems.
Mm-hmm.
She gets a lot of, brown sort of yeasty wax.
Okay.
And I have, a thing I bought at for her ears that I cleanse it every day. I clean it out, sort of rub it in, and then she shakes it out, and I wipe out the excess. But, it helps. Right away, but within a couple hours, she seems to have a lot of buildup. And as of recently, it just gets really bad where, she'll get stains on her, dog bed.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Yeah. Whenever we're dealing with an ear infection, it's always a good idea, rather than just trying to keep them clean at home, to find out exactly what the bug is. And this would be something, you said it smells like yeast. If she does have a yeast infection in her ears, cleaning alone is probably not going to be the solution to your dog's problem. Usually we're looking at using either topical antifungal drugs, which may be in ointments and so on. There's even some new ear flushes that have ketoconazole, which is an antifungal agent, in them as well. And for long-term use, that might be something you could use. But typically, to just knock this thing out, we're looking at using an oral antifungal drug. And usually I use the drug that I just mentioned called ketoconazole. It's a good idea to make sure that your veterinarian looks in the ears if they can. Many dogs with chronic ear infections will have ruptured eardrums, and you've got a middle ear infection, and you would think that they would be in horrible pain with this, but you'd be surprised how many dogs are walking around with ruptured eardrums, and they can still hear okay. It's maybe a little muffled, but it acts as a source of infection. So sometimes what we need to do is actually give the dog general anesthesia so we can get in and get these ears totally cleaned out and start with a clean slate, oral medication, and then get you going on an appropriate cleaning schedule to help keep it under control. The question I always have, though, is why does this dog have, if it is a yeast infection, a recurrent yeast infection? It usually means that there's some other underlying problem. Either they're hypothyroid, or they have allergies, or something that's affecting the chemistry of the ear canal, which is one of the places when dogs have allergies or endocrine diseases tends to be affected. So you may be looking at even getting a little more workup done to see if there's some other underlying cause for this.
Yeah, she was a stray that was found, and we adopted her through Maddox in Milwaukee, and that's just how she came. Her ears came like that, and they did give us, like, the vet where we got her, they gave us, like, a thing, I think the medication that you were describing, she came with that for her ears, and we used that for a number of weeks, and that seemed to work, but she still seemed to get the reoccurrence of the yeast all the time. So then we got like a topical, or like a thing that, you know, you rinse out her ears and stuff, but it just never seemed to go away.
And that's probably because she's got some other underlying like allergies or something that is triggering this. And so if we've got in
weepy eyes really bad too, and that was another question. Her eyes get really weepy, and she's just always been like that, and we do the thing where we can wipe, but she still gets a lot of tear stains, like weepy eyes, and it kind of goes along with her ears. So, yeah, maybe it is something.
Yeah, so she's probably got some other underlying problem, and then you may be looking at going down the allergy workup to see if you can figure out why her ears are, you know, staying infected and inflamed all the time.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in as well by calling 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Shirley in Prentice, Wisconsin next. Hi, Shirley.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. I've got a couple of quick questions. Okay. I have a 12-year-old Karen Terrier, a male, who had a rather severe intestinal infection, and we got it cleared up through my vet with medication and prescription ID for him, for canned, both canned and the dry Enova. And he's just fine now, and I'm still feeding him just what the vet told me to. And looking at the can, the Hill's prescription, I see all the turkey and the rice and all that, and plus a whole lot of chemicals. So I'm wondering if I could make my own. I'd still feed the Enova, but could I make my own kind of slash?
That is a really good question. Intestinal diet, any of the therapeutic diets that are meant to keep the, you know, gut healthy, they classically are used for dogs that have diarrhea and things, and so they are low residue foods, meaning they don't have a lot of fiber in them. They're highly digestible, which means that it's going to take some of the work away from the intestinal tract, and they're also low in fat, because fat's one of the more difficult ingredients in the food to be able to digest. And so coming up with a diet, sometimes in a pinch, if an owner calls me, you know, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they can't get in to pick anything up, I'll tell them to boil up some white rice, not brown rice because that's going to have more fiber, but white rice, and maybe boil some chicken or boil some hamburger to get all the fat off of it, and use that as a temporary substitute. But for long-term use, if you were going to come up with a diet like that, you would obviously have to add in, you know, minerals and vitamins and so on, because it's not going to be well balanced. All those things that you're seeing on the can are, you know, primarily things that keep it in it, making it a balanced diet. It's, you know, ID is one of those ones that we've used for years. We have dogs on it for extended periods of time. It's well balanced. They can stay on it. It's not like some of the other therapeutic diets where they may not be able to stay on it long term. ID is one that they can. So if you do want to do a home cooked diet, make sure that you're working with a veterinary nutritionist to come up with a diet. There is a website called balanceit.com. That just happens to be one of the websites that is available. I'm going through my notes here and I'm going to try to find this other one for you. But if you go to the American College of Veterinary Nutrition, which is acvn.org, they have a list of different websites and so on that are going to be helpful for you that you can then go to for, you know, getting recipes for homemade diets. There may be a fee for it, so don't be surprised, but they would want to probably know a little bit of the health history of your dog and why they have to be on this diet long term. But they could come up with a diet for you with the right ingredients to make it well balanced.
Mm-hmm. My second question, I'm going to ask it and then hang up because I have such a poor connection, is how do you judge a good dry dog food? I've always liked Enova. It's expensive, but I think it's worth it. And so I'll hang up now and turn the radio on. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
right.
A really good question. It's sometimes you get what you pay for. And so the less expensive foods you can get at some of the, you know, big box stores and so on, are probably, you know, lower quality. But I always say that the dog or the cat is the one that tells you whether the food is good or not. And so first of all, you have to be able to afford it. You need to be able to have easy access to it. It's not something that has to be, you know, ship long distance or whatever. Your dog has to like it. And it needs to meet the life stages of the life stage that you're feeding, whether it be a puppy or an adult dog or whatever. And, you know, so those are all things that you have to look at. Then you start looking at how's your dog's coat quality, stool volume and quality, and just does the dog tolerate it? Because even some of the better diets out there, there are some dogs that just don't tolerated. So obviously that would not be the appropriate food for that particular dog. Things that you want to be looking at on the bag are you need to look for a statement that says that this food has gone through AFCO testing. It stands for American Association of Feed Control Officials. And I've just had someone come in with a bag of food and said, is this a good food? And it says on there, she said, it says AFCO. And I said, but read it more carefully. And it says, the food is designed to meet AFCO standards. That means that that food was made and never fed to any dogs before it went on the market. Didn't necessarily have to be fed. They just kind of looked at what the cookbook said and said, let's just make that diet. And there are variations in how well, you know, proteins are metabolized and so on. So even though it may meet the standards, doesn't mean that the dogs are going to do well on it. So you always want to make sure that you're dealing with a company that's actually feeding it to dogs to make sure that they can tolerate it and do well for their entire life.
Great points. Thank you very much for calling, by the way. Lynette in Hubertus. Let's go to you now. Hi, Lynette.
Hi. I have several outdoor cats, but one of them, he's practically morbidly obese, but that's a whole other question. The problem is he has developed really thick mats along the top of his back, and they are so thick. He allows me to pet him. He allows me to brush him, but there's no way of getting those out. Even if I tried cutting, it's down to the skin. That's how bad it is. Is it eventually just going to grow out and fall out that I don't need to worry about it, or do I take him take him in and have him sedated and have it shaved off.
Yeah. You know, when we have cats that are overweight, we will often see problems with mats because they can't reach around and groom themselves. Sometimes the initial sign will just be kind of this greasy, flaky stripe down their back. And that tells me, you know, this cat is just not getting back there and keeping their coat clean. So it's up to you to be able to, you know, not only get them on a diet and help them that way if you can, but that would be something you can work with your veterinarian. But picking up a pair of scissors and cutting them off, you really, because you cats have such elastic skin, you run the risk of nicking the skin, and then there's no way you'll ever get near him again. Shaving is by far the best way. If he's kind of a quasi-feral cat, that he may need sedation to have that done. So, you know, getting him in a cat carrier, that's going to be your first step. And then calling your veterinarian to say, you know, can I bring him in? And although most veterinarians are not groomers or have a groomer on staff, you know, we get this happening all the time where we have a cat that you just need to give him a little sedation so that you can make it comfortable for them so you can get in there with clippers and get all of that hair off their back. But you'd be surprised. Some cats come into the vet clinic and they'll just sit there on the table and it feels so good to get that big hair mat off the back. If you leave that there, if it gets wet, you can have secondary skin infections. And plus, you've got the discomfort for the cat that every time they're walking, their hair is pulling and it just makes it even worse. And he's probably going to get fatter because he doesn't move or exercise because when I move, my hair pulls. So I think it's a good idea to get him in and get that taken care of. But one of my little quick practice tips for people that have a cat that they're trying to get a little mat out of maybe is using a seam ripper. If anybody, you know, you can go to any fabric store or any place that they sell sewing notions. It's a little tiny protected blade and there's a little ball on one of the ends to protect fabric. And so you can just slide that under the mat and just, it takes a long time, but you won't cut the skin because you've got a blade there that's just going to be cutting the hair. And I found that that works really well, especially for small mats. But a big one like this, you'd be working at it for hours. Yeah.
Okay, there you go. Thanks, Lynette.
Thank you.
Judy in Superior, it is your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. See, I have a question about feral cats. I have 7 cats. They're all indoor, all spayed and neutered. Of the 7, 5 of them were feral cats when I brought them into my house. And of the 5 feral cats, 2 of them were kittens. And now these, they're all grown. They've been in my house for over 5 years. But the 2 that were brought to my house that were the kittens, I have never been able to tame them, to be able to hold them, pet them. And I'm just very surprised because the adult cats are wonderful. But I'm just wondering if you have any tips of anything I can do to tame these. Well, they're adults now, but to be able to hold
them.
Tough
to do now.
Yeah, it really is tough to do now. And this is just gives you an idea of when people refer to, you know, a outdoor stray cat as feral. Some of these cats are actually previously owned. They've been well socialized to people and touch when they were little babies. And by some unfortunate circumstance, they ended up getting lost, dumped off in the country. Something happened. They get picked up. Those are, you know, they are classified as feral, but they're still very tame and, you know, cats that can just step right into a household and not have any trouble. Other cats, if these were little, the most important time for socializing cats to touch is in that first 7 weeks of life. So if mom was totally afraid of people, these kittens were isolated and not handled by people in those first early formative weeks of life, you may never get a cat to turn around. I have a cat at home. Her name is Cheerio. I bought her an airline ticket from California when I was out there and was at a cat show, and she was a rescue with a cat group that was, you know, adopting cats out. And I have had her now for about 7 years. And maybe about once a month I can touch her, if I'm lucky. And so I just accepted that she's part of my family. I love her to death. She's a beautiful kitty. She loves my other 2 cats. Everybody gets along. But, you know, she's never going. And I've had her since she was just a smaller cat. She's an adult now. So she's maybe 6, 7 months of age. And I just accept the fact that, you know what, you're part of our family, but we just, we're not going to bother you because that just makes her more stressed. So play hard to get, and maybe the kittens will, or the cats will come to you. If you keep forcing yourself on them, that's a good way to have them just be, you know, staying even more aloof. So.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yep. That sounds just like, our cats. And they were, the kittens were about 10 to 12 weeks old when they were trapped. So they had had no contact with humans before then. Yeah.
But just think, they've got a wonderful, safe life with you. They're happy. They have friends, good nutrition. And, you know, you just don't have a cuddly cat. So kind of accept them as they are.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Eileen in Whitefish Bay, we are on to you now. Hi, Eileen.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Well, I actually have more of a human question than a dog question.
Okay.
I had my little baby, my little angel. I'm sorry. I treated her like a little child. I adored her.
A little cat or a dog?
For 16 years.
Is this a cat or a dog? Cat or
a
dog?
A dog. My little dog. Yes,
okay.
My little dog. She was a little Shih Tzu poo, and I was crazy about her. And age finally got to her, and she had to be put down, and it broke my heart and whatnot. And anyway, my problem is that I truly want another dog, and guess what? The old man doesn't want anything to do with it.
Oh.
It's really been a struggle because I have a daughter who's currently briefly living at home, and we've set up a deal where we would actually agree to buy the dog together, and then she would take the dog when she goes, and then we'd be grandma and grandpa, so to speak. But unfortunately, he doesn't seem amenable to any of these issues. And I just wanted to give her deal with that with adults, who are actually husband and wives who are actually debating over whether or not to get an animal. And if so, how to resolve the problem.
Marital counseling. I think you're calling the wrong person. But, this is a tough situation. Whenever you're bringing a pet into the family, I mean, obviously, your little angel was with you for 16 years. It's a huge commitment. And perhaps, you know, your husband is looking at that you're at a point in your life that he wants to travel more. He wants, you know, to not be tied down. The trick is going to be finding out why he doesn't want another pet in the house, whether it's because, you know, whether it's he doesn't want to have to go through training a puppy. Well, then maybe getting an adult dog may be a little bit easier thing to do. Or, you know, maybe it's the expense of having a new dog. And so coming up with some way of, saying, I'll get a part-time job to support the dog. Maybe to get his heart back into this, you may want to contact a local shelter that's looking for foster families just to be able to have a dog in your home that is temporary to give you your dog fix that you need. But you realize that, you know, it's going to be, you know, going to its forever home at some point unless... foster families, you become foster failures and everybody falls in love and you end up adopting the dog. So that might be another way of approaching it. But
he wanted nothing to do with the first dog we got. He agreed to do it only because he felt for our children's sake it was a good thing to do. Now, that was 1992, and he wasn't even sure what day the dog was coming home.
Yeah. And see, not everybody is an animal lover. And that's, and so much of that is how they're, you know, you're raised as children, whether you're exposed to pets, whether they become part of your life. So that's something that unfortunately, before someone gets married in the future, and if they want pets, that's got to be, you know, on the list of things to discuss. You know, do you want kids? Do you want dogs? You know, where do you want to live? You know, that kind of thing. So, yeah. Sorry, I don't have any other suggestions.
Well, I do like the idea, though, of having bringing a dog home and, you know, until he finds or she finds a forever home.
Yeah, I think that's great. It serves everybody well. It gives the dog a temporary home. It gives the, woman, Eileen, a chance to be able to have a dog to care for. And you never know. You may just turn that guy around.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're having some problems with our printers here at the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, so We haven't been able to get any emails today, so I would encourage you not to email us until we get our printer problem solved. And if you have and you haven't heard from us, well, it's because of the printer. So give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That'll be the way to get on today. Greg and Hazelhurst, you are up next. Hi, Greg. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I would like a few pointers. We just brought home a seven-week-old Basset puppy Sunday. And we will need to be kenneling her. And I was wondering if you could give me some do's or don'ts.
So when you say kenneling, you mean using a crate for confinement in your home when you can't be there watching her 100% of the time? Or
right.
Okay. You know, she's just a baby right now, and crate training is something even though everybody says, hey, you know, you provide a dog with a comfortable little cave that they can sleep in, you know, they'll just jump right in and be happy with it. It needs to be something that the dog learns. So I would introduce the crate. I like to have a crate, especially at night in your bedroom, so that in case she wakes up in the middle of the night and needs to go to the bathroom, you are right there to be able to get the dog out of the crate and get it outside rather than having her, you know, have a mess in the crate.
Mm-hmm.
Seven-week-old puppies, just, again, throwing food in, having them go in for just a little brief period of time and come right back out again so it's not a jail. Never use it for punishment. And at 7-8 weeks of age, they should be able to tolerate probably 3 or 4 hours of time confined, so that you need to get up early enough in the morning to be able to feed her, go to, you know, let her go outside and eliminate, get some exercise, so that then she just zonks out and sleeps in her crate. And then if someone needs to come home at noon, let her out, go through the same thing again. Going for a full work day, not going to happen for a few weeks. So you got to be careful. I had a client actually that was very worried about their pet. They ended up putting in a webcam, and they signed up to some, you know, site that you can then just log in and watch. And they gave me the site so I could log in and watch the dog. And we even did such things as call on the phone, okay, at work. And then the dog would wake up and look at us. I just wanted to see, did the dog settle back down again? Or was it up and barking? Or how did it do? And it was really helpful because I think the owner was more concerned about leaving the dog in the crate than the dog was. And so that might be something to help alleviate some of your fears that your dog may be not doing well. But watch for signs of distress. Drooling, well, I mean, it's a Basset. They all drool anyways. Digging at the crate, chewing things up. If you're noticing those kinds of behaviors, then obviously the crate is a very stressful spot for the dog. If you have to be gone for longer than, 3 or 4 hours, then I would have the dog confined to a small room that's been dog-proof, like a bathroom or a small laundry room. The crate can be at one end so that it, with the door open, so they can sleep, and you can have, you know, a little bit of water or something for her to eat, some toys. You can put papers down to make cleanup easier. You're not paper training, but you're giving her an alternative spot to go to the bathroom rather than having to go on her bedding in the crate. So if, you know, from those days where somebody can't get home, obviously you got to meet the dog's needs. So that would work out just fine.
On the days that I can be home, how long a stretch, you know, if I'm here, should I put her in for?
The rules of housebreaking is that 100% of your attention's on the dog. So I would be in the crate while I'm having a shower, in the crate while I'm checking my email, in the crate while I'm eating breakfast, you know. So you can do lots of little times in the crate. And I think that would work out. That's great while you're at home, because that teaches her that the world doesn't end if I'm not right next to Dad, but I can be comfortable in my crate and, you know, play with my toy or maybe just have a nap. Mm-hmm. I think little times when you're at home are just as important, so that she's not always out of the crate when you're at home.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Lou in Rosendale, it's your turn. Hi, Lou.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have an elderly Siamese cat. She's about 18 years old. She was a rescue cat, so I'm not really sure, but she's at least that old. And she's got arthritis pretty bad. I don't want to take her to a vet because she hasn't had any immunizations. She's strictly an indoor cat, and we've never had any problem with any kind of disease, except when I took her in to be spayed, she got the respiratory disease, rhinitis, I guess it is.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm really afraid to take her back to a vet, because she was very, very sick when she got that. She is very, very stiff, especially in her hind end, and quite weak in her hind end. Sometimes she, like if she jumps off the couch, which she does very carefully, and she can still get up on a low couch, even though she mm-hmm. spend quite a bit of time sizing up the situation.
Yeah.
And getting, she has like just enough strength to oomph herself up there. But when she jumps off, oftentimes her hind end slips out from under her.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, should she be on some medication?
Or, yeah, and unfortunately,
I imagine she's in quite a bit of pain, although she hasn't done anything recently. Last year during the winter, occasionally she would just cry out. You know, she'd
poor thing.
Howl like she was in pain.
Yeah. Some of the signs that we'll see of cats with arthritis are similar to what you're describing, Lou, such as, you know, taking more care, jumping up and down, crying out, being stiff, not curling up in a ball like they normally do, taking a little bit of extra time, you know, getting up from a nap because their joints are stiff. Sometimes we'll even see them not wanting to use the litter box or doing what I call elevator butt, where they get in the box and they can't squat because their knees hurt or their hips hurt.
I don't see that.
Yeah. So, but I'm just saying that in general, that anybody listening, if they've got a cat that's doing that kind of thing, sometimes we have to start thinking about arthritis. Things that you can do, and I'm going to bring up the vaccination issue as well, because I think you've got a couple of misconceptions there about herpes, which was the rhinotracheitis that she got when she was at the vet clinic. But things that you can do, similar to what we do in dogs, you can get little stairs that go up to your sofa so she doesn't have to jump up and down off of it. They do make them. They're little pet ramps and so on that are adjustable, and you can have those strategically placed around the house. Make sure that if, you know, you've got litter boxes that she has easy access to, that she doesn't have to go down to the basement to use the litter box. You can put her on some glucosamine chondroitin sulfate, and that would be something that you may want to talk to a veterinarian about getting a dose for her. There are prescription drugs that you could try, but again, you'd have to go to a veterinarian to be able to get them. There's one that is labeled for cat use called meloxicam. She'd have to have a little bit of blood work checked to make sure that her liver and kidneys are working okay, but that is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory that is labeled for cat use. You have to be really careful about using that particular class of drugs in cats. And just to, you know, grab something over the counter, if you were to give your cat even a tiny amount of Tylenol, you would kill it. If you were to give your cat aspirin, same thing. I mean, you really, really have to be careful with cats with some of these drugs that humans just, you know, take for granted and grab over the counter. There are diets on the market for cats, too. There's a joint diet like we have for cats or for dogs. There's one called JD that Hills makes. That's the only one that's on the market right now that have extra levels of fatty acids, in particular fish oils. But again, it's a prescription diet. You would have to get it through a veterinarian via prescription. You wouldn't be able to buy it over the counter. So back to your question about going to the veterinarian. Obviously, you love your cat. You've had her for years. And the misconception regarding vaccines is that it is rabies is the law in most communities. It's not a state law, but it is a law in most communities. So if your cat were to bite somebody, such as, you know, you went over to help her get down and she got hurt and she bit you and you went into the doctor, you could be in trouble. She would have to go in and be quarantined because she's not current on her rabies vaccine. So you may want to consider having that looked into. I would strongly recommend it. Regarding the fact that you think she got herpes at the vet clinic, it's possible, but many cats get exposed to herpes from their mom when they're little babies. And it's kind of like us with cold sores and so on. You get a little stressed and guess what? You get a cold sore again. It's not meaning that at the time of stress, you picked up the cold sore. it means that you probably had the virus there in your body and it just came out. Well, herpes in cats is rhinotracheitis, and the stress of going into the hospital may have caused a recurrence of a disease that she was just harboring in her body and not showing any symptoms of. So it may not have been the vet clinic. Most likely it isn't, because if you do get cats with upper respiratory diseases in, vet clinics have isolation wards. We tend to like to keep those cats away from everybody because they are, those diseases are so contagious. So revisit your thoughts about going to a vet. We want your cat to live a long time, and Siamese cats can live into their 20s with appropriate care.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Martha in Kearney, Michigan, hi to you.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. We're going to my daughter's house in Baraboo, and she's got fleas. She has a dog and she has a cat. And this flea business has been going on for a while, and she just can't get rid of them. What should she do?
Well, I hope that she is using a good product on the dogs and cats. And by that, I mean something that the veterinarian would recommend. Frontline, Advantage for fleas. Make sure you're using the appropriate product on dogs and cats. Sometimes the over-the-counter products, you maybe think you're saving some money, but they're not as effective. So this is one area where you do get what you pay for when it comes to flea control. Be on the lookout for wildlife and so on. If she has raccoons or squirrels or things like that, bunnies coming into the yard, they can be a source of a chronic source of fleas for the pets that are going in and out. So just to give you an example, a raccoon spends the night on the deck and leaves flea eggs behind. They hatch into larvae. Dog goes out, and once those larvae turn into adult fleas, they jump up and are on the dog again. So, you know, monthly treatment, vacuuming the house really well, especially areas where the pets sleep. Those would be the big things to be looking at. So,
and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. She'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thank you for listening in and joining us today. We have many callers online, and you know what? Chuck's been waiting a long time from Ladysmith, so we will go to Chuck right away. Chuck, thank you for waiting.
Oh, thanks. My question would be, I've got a one-year-old English Golden Retriever, and when he was a pup and we brought him home, he contacted parvo. Well, we took him to the vet with the parvo, and they said, take him home. He isn't going to last the night. So my wife is a nurse, and we had to take high-bore IVs and put it in his back and fill him with water to hydrate him, and we take peanut butter and put it on the top of his mouth so he gets sugar. And every time we did this, he'd sit on my lap and he'd look at me while my wife did this. He wouldn't look me in the eye, and he'd just scream when we stuck the needles in him.
Aww.
But the point that I'd like to find out is he kind of holds a grudge now. He won't look us in the eye, and he's not friendly. He doesn't want to come near us. Is this going to change? That's my question.
Oh, you know, he's a year of age right now, and so often, you know, personality is something that they may inherit from their mom or their dad. And so whenever someone is getting a new puppy, I always say, don't look at the puppies. Make sure you visit with mom, and preferably mom and dad. And if mom or dad are kind of the extremes of behavior, very fearful and shy or very assertive, those would be the puppies to avoid. So I don't know kind of what kind of the family background he had. The other part of it is, you know, early socialization early in life, where he has lots of pleasant activities, lots of handling, you know, early handling. I really doubt that your treatment triggered this. I think that most dogs are, when they're sick, they're very forgiving, because we do a lot of things like this to dogs with sub-Q fluids and so on. And they never look back. In fact, they come back. They want to come back into the clinic. They're happy to come back in. So it may just be your dog's own personality. And, you know, best thing you can do is when you've got a dog that is very shy and not wanting to be social is, you know, just going about things very, very slowly, finding something that your dog is passionate about, whether it be catching a ball or food, and incorporating that into every time you're approaching him, where, you know, you get him to maybe look at you and then get a treat, that he just gives you a little eye glance. And so working with a trainer is going to help you with, you know, perhaps coming up with a plan of action for helping your dog out. Trying to do it on your own may be a little difficult.
Yep, there you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. We, you know, we were talking earlier, Sandy, about wild, weird things that dogs will eat. And Joe emailed us to say we had a beagle that ate a spool of thread with the end sticking out of its mouth about 2 feet. He tried to paw it out, but only was unwinding the spool.
Yeah.
He ended up taking him in to get it cut out.
Yeah. And, you know, we'll see dogs swallowing fish hooks and have a piece of line coming out of their mouth. And I remember as a new graduate veterinarian having an owner that they saw their dog swallow it and they tried to pull it out.
Oh.
Well, you know what fish hooks do. They hook in and tore his esophagus. And unfortunately, the dog didn't make it. But, you know, so if you see a thread hanging out of your dog's mouth, don't pull on it, okay? Because you never know what it's attached to. I mean, a little, maybe a very gentle tug, but especially if you think there's a fish hook, don't do that. Yeah.
Let's go to Susan in Bristol next. Susan, thank you for waiting.
Well, hello, and thank you for taking my call. Good afternoon. I have two dogs. One is Aston, and she's a Weimaraner, and she's my doggy daughter, and she's perfect, so I don't have a problem with her. But Duke... He's they're both rescues, but Duke is a lab bloodhound mix, one of those designer mutts. When I got him, he was nothing but a furry bag of bones and worms, and he's now a big, healthy guy, but he's got this behavioral problem that he won't come into the house from outside. He's terrified. And he will, I have to trick him. First, I did the Hansel and Gretel thing. That worked for a while. I put, like, some cheese popcorn on the floor in a line and stuff, and then go up and close the door real fast when he came in. And after a while, he got in tune to that. So I have to hide around the corner in the kitchen and peek out, and he'll just put, like, 1 foot in at a time, and I'll put a bowl of food in the living room floor where he can see it, and I make him watch me pour it, and he'll come in, and... But I have to hide around the corner because if he sees me, he won't come in, and he'll just very, very carefully come walking in the house, and I have to run up, hide him, and slam the door.
So when he's in the house, what is he like? Does he then relax, eats, and he'll just...
Yeah, no, he'll come to me when he's in the house.
Okay.
And when I'm outside with him, he'll come to me outside. He just doesn't want to come in the door. I'm wondering if maybe something happened where this is what I think it was. I think whoever had him before who mistreated him, they probably beat him when he was called, you know, because he didn't come right away. That's what I'm kind of thinking.
Yeah, and that's possible. But, you know, again, it just may be that he's a very shy dog, or if he was, you know, again, something, anything that could have happened that frightened him around a doorway. Maybe his tail got stuck in the door, or the wind blew the glass, you know, the door shut behind him and it made a loud noise. You can have some dogs that are one-time learners, that you have something bad associated with an event, and they just, you know, think that, okay, that, you know, anytime I walk through the door now, something bad's going to happen. So that's, you know, don't think that he was abused, but, you know, anytime you're wanting to teach a dog to come to you, it can't be associated with something bad. So I'd be working out back. Like you said, he's coming to you now when you're outside. So instead of, you know, just having him come, make sure you come, he comes to you, you call him, you give him a food treat, let him go again, comes to you, and incorporate in all of that too, reaching down and touching his collar so that you also have a handle that you can work with. Does he come in if you have him on a leash? Will he walk in?
He'll jump away, but if I have him on a leash and I do have a pinch collar for him, you know, just so, because he really, he works well with it. And if I'm walking him around on that, I mean, I live on many acres and stuff, so he's free to, like, kind of run around and stuff, and that's when he won't come in. If I have him on a leash, he's very good on a leash.
Okay.
And he will walk right in the door with me on a leash.
Okay, so here's what you need to do. You're going to have to break down, reaching down and putting the leash on him when he's outside into 100 little steps. And it may just be leaning slightly over him as you give him a treat. And then having your hand out a little bit further, gradually getting to the point where you touch his collar, but then you go play. And so after you've done that, he starts associating with, I come, I sit, Mom touches my collar, and guess what? I get to go play again. It doesn't mean I'm going to be hooked up. If the fun isn't over. And eventually, you'll get to the point where then you put the leash on, unhook it, let him go play. Put the leash on and start walking him to the house, let him go play again. And break it down into lots and lots of little bits. This would be something, again, where a trainer, an applied animal behaviorist would be able to help you with desensitizing him to you approaching with your hand touching his collar, so you can get a leash on him easily and you can bring him in the house.
Good luck.
Yeah, because thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. What's the prognosis, one of our emailers wants to know, for small dogs with diabetes? The month since my mini poodle has been diagnosed, he's had a urinary infection. He hates being injected with insulin twice daily. She hates doing it. Lois, this is. As it's hard to be so tied to the clock and the needle. The disease seems to be under control. Will it shorten his life? What other complications?
Oh, you know, good question. I'm working with a diabetic dog right now, and it's not an inexpensive disease to treat, especially when you're first starting to get them regulated. Best thing you can do if you can, and some cases you can prevent diabetes by making sure that you don't allow your pets to get fat, because there seems to be a very, just like in humans, strong correlation between obesity and the formation of diabetes. You are tied. You can't, leave this dog. You have to be on a special schedule, and it's very unfortunate when that happens. There are some people that have diabetic dogs that they actually hire veterinary technicians that do house calls to be able to, if they have to be, gone out for dinner or whatever, to be able to give them their insulin. Work with your veterinarian to come up with perhaps how you're injecting the insulin is, uncomfortable. It's a tiny needle, and it shouldn't be that uncomfortable, especially, again, if you associate it with something pleasant. I usually like to give the dog part of their food, make sure that they're eating, and while they're eating, give them their insulin. So they're thinking, ooh, food, and I have somebody touching me in my back, but no big deal. Then you can give them the rest of their food. And that seems to work a little bit better. But have it become a routine where you're always doing it in the same location, and it's always associated with something fun or good happening, such as eating. Don't go through the, chasing him and making it be a big game or something stressful. But it's a tough one. People that have diabetic animals, oh, God bless them, because they're, twice a day they're having to give insulin and lots of visits into the vet. They're expensive. So, good luck. Yeah.
On to Karen and Amory. Hi, Karen. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I care part-time for a little kitty next door. And it's fed and has a basic shelter, but its head is so full of mucus that it's just miserable all the time. It looks like it's 15 years old and it's 3, and I just don't know how to help it. It's now so bad that the nose drips all the time, and the eyes this week are welded shut now. So,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's pretty bad, and she's just the sweetest kitty you could ever imagine.
Does the kitty have an owner?
Yes. And, she's a nice person and cooperative with me, but I have, if I volunteered to take her, I tried to take her home with me at one time, but no, she wanted to keep it,
But this cat is at a point where it needs emergency veterinary care.
Okay.
And so either convince the owner to get it into a veterinarian, or you volunteer to do it and get this cat looked at and treated. I'd be screening it for the diseases that suppress the immune system, like feline leukemia and FIV, checking, the eyes to make sure that they don't have any corneal ulcers or anything that need to be treated, getting the cat going on an appropriate antibiotic to help clear up the infection. And if it's not been eating well or anything, it may need to be on fluid therapy. This cat is very ill, thank you for being a good Samaritan and making sure that it's fed, but it needs more than that right now, or
sure
it's not going to survive.
I sure do know that. I just want to know that there's something that can be done. You know, right now my hands are a little tied, although I would contribute financially to it just because the kitty is so precious.
You're going to have to talk to that owner.
Yeah, so hang up, go over to the owner's house and get that cat in this afternoon to a veterinary clinic.
Good luck. Thank you for calling. And Joy in Eau Claire, we're on to you. Hi, Joy.
It's Joyce. Hello. I'm calling about redirected aggression with one of my cats. It concerns a cat that comes around, an outdoor cat. My cats are indoors. And this has happened 3 times now. And my cat goes into this terrible, one of my cats, I have two, goes into this terrible attack mode. And I've seen it twice, and thankfully he didn't attack my cat. But recently, I did not see it happen, but the one cat bit the other one. And it was quite bad. I had to take him to the vet.
Oh, boy. These are really tough situations to take care of. When you're saying redirected aggression, you know, classic scenario is two cats sitting in a window seat looking out a window. A stray cat comes up from outside and one of the cats gets into attack mode to go through the glass and want to attack the cat that's on the outside, but instead turns around and bites their housemate who is laying next to them and couldn't care less about another cat approaching. That's such a classic presentation. And all I can tell you is that number one suggestion in every behavior book is avoid situations that trigger this type of redirected response, which means that you keep your windows shut, you put up blinds on the windows, you get live trap the stray cat that's outside and have it taken to a shelter for hopefully adoption, and to just allow your cats to have some peace. If you do see your cat in this very stressed state, do not try to touch it with your hands. You will get bit. Using a pillow, piece of cardboard, something to try to get them separated, have the cat isolated until it is extreme, calm down and over this situation. That can sometimes take hours to days. Sometimes the cat that's on the receiving end is now going to be in defensive mode all the time that, I have no idea why you're attacking me, but just out of the blue, you suddenly bite me. And now you've got two cats that are constantly fighting in the house. So keeping the cat separate after an incident like that, and then gradual introduction with supervision so that you can avoid any other fighting. But it is really a tough situation to be in. I feel for you, but that stray cat's got to be taken care of, unfortunately.
Yep. Could I ask one more question about that?
All right.
Sure. Yes. I'm just wondering, of course you really can't answer this, but do you think with a cat that does this, my cat, that he would do this with any stray cat, or it would be this one, could it be just one particular cat?
I don't know. It could be any stray cat. Sometimes it's just smelling a cat. Sometimes it's hearing another cat's voice. There are all kinds of triggers. I had one family that had a cat that anytime a family member would start to yell and voices were raised, the cat would go over and bite them. And so they thought it was wonderful because at that point they had a teenager at home. And so that it kept kind of the family peace. So there's lots of triggers. Vacuum cleaners will sometimes trigger a cat to go into attack mode. Seeing a dog, smells, if you were to come home smelling like another cat, that could trigger it too. So there are many, many things, and it's really hard to predict. It comes down to your observation as to, this cat comes into the yard, my cat doesn't do anything, the other cat, yep, that's what triggers it. So your guess is as good as mine at this point.
Thank you for calling, Joyce. Appreciate your call. Ken in Milwaukee, we turn to you. Hi, Ken.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Larry.
Sure.
I have a cat, a guild cat and a hairball problem, which came first, right? She throws up a hairball or dark, liquidy, very acidic substance. We took her into the vet, and they had to get some, like, a Pepcid, a half a pill of that every night because what it is that her sleeping schedule adopted to ours, so she wouldn't eat at night, so her stomach would get upset. So we give her these at night to help her calm her stomach. However, it doesn't work all the time. She's still throwing up. If we don't give her the pill, she throws up every night.
Okay.
We're taking her in again, but we had the blood test done. Everything came back normal. So I'm trying to get another possible opinion on that.
Yeah. Many people think that every time a cat vomits, it has to be due to hairballs. And the hair may just be going along for the ride, and the cat's vomiting for some other reason. And the list of causes for vomiting is long. You've probably ruled out things like liver disease, kidney disease, and so on, which can cause a cat to have an upset stomach by having blood work done. You may want to be looking at, diet changes and so on. There are some diets that are for sensitive stomach and things. You are at a point right now, though, where you have to start looking at some of the other causes, such as inflammatory bowel disease, pancreatitis. There's lots and lots of other different things. Even something is like heartworm. Cats will chronically vomit with heartworm disease. We think of that as a dog disease, but that's something that cats can get. So I think where you're at right now is probably getting an abdominal ultrasound done to be able to look at the internal organs, to be able to see the pancreas. There are some blood tests that you can do that are specific for the pancreas. If you have not already had that done, that might be a little bit easier to get that off the table. Yeah. And then, then you're looking at scoping and biopsying. So actually going in with an endoscope and having a look at the stomach and getting some little biopsies and seeing what's going on in there to see if they can figure out, an answer for you.
Okay.
Some owners choose to not go that route and doing a therapeutic trial of a hypoallergenic diet, such as there's some that are hydrolyzed protein diets. There's one called ZD that you can feed to cats that they do quite well on. There's a couple of other companies that make limited antigen diets as well. Sometimes a trial of steroids may help too. But again, you're not getting a definitive answer, but it may be helpful.
Yep,
so
there you go. All right. Thank you very much for calling. Carson in Lake Geneva has a good friend facing a possible eviction. The end of September, he has a wonderful 5-year-old female border collie. Besides the financial crisis, he's in a major panic, wondering what to do with his dog. Doesn't have any family members who can take the dog. None of his friends are looking to add a dog. He's adamant about not taking it to a pound or shelter. He insists the dog go to a good home. Sad situation, breaks my heart. What are his options?
Well, the fact that the dog is a purebred dog, and it doesn't even have to be a purebred dog, but his best bet is going to a rescue group, which sometimes means starting out with a shelter. Many shelters, if a purebred dog comes in, they will contact Border Collie Rescue. And they've got foster families that'll take the dog. We've already mentioned that on the show. And foster it for a while until a forever home could be found. And I think that's going to be the dog's best bet. And it's such an unfortunate thing, but it happens all the time to people. So,
yeah, it's what about adopting one or two kittens at a time?
If you want a multi-cat household, start with one. It's always easier to start with two kitties, but you have to make sure that you provide enough litter boxes and so on. Two cats, 3 litter boxes. So think about that if you've got a small spot. Maybe you're in a 1 or 2 bedroom apartment and you're thinking, I'm going to get a kitty because it's a good pet. But, if you want to get 2, think about where you're going to put those extra resources for the cats.
Yeah, so one is better than 2 to begin with?
One cat?
Yeah.
Well, if you can only get one, then
one. Two is better.
Yeah.
All right,
two is
better.
They play with each other. You have less aggressive play directed towards people. They bond with each other. I think it's a wonderful idea to get 2 if you've got
I heartily agree with that.
You've got 2 and you know.
We had 1 for a little while, then we added.
Yep.
And it made all the difference in the world to our first cat.
They've got a buddy. But you introduced that cat when Tiger was a very young cat. So that helped. And so once they get kind of old and set in their ways, it's harder to introduce another one.
Well, Sandy, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. And I think we have a date.
Yes, on the 19th. I'll be back.
October 19th. Sandy will be back and we'll do this all over again with her. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is a clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I just invite you to take a look at my Facebook page for the radio station. The Larry Mueller Show is the title of my Facebook page. We always have lots of good things up on it. And I hope you'll help us take some days off of our fall pledge drive For every 800 donations we get ahead of time, we're taking one day off. And right now we're at, what is it, 517. So we are 517 pledges away from taking the first day off. So go to WPR.org to donate now, and we'll take a day off the pledge drive, which is a very good thing. I like that idea. Coming up tomorrow, good show tomorrow, too, at 11, we'll talk about saving the barns here in Wisconsin with Chuck Law of the UW-Madison Extension and Jerry Apps, writer, obviously been with us many times from Madison.